This is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal, as usual, on the biz page. And under the heading of First Place comes the article, Campbell Law Adds Hardware After Winning Competition. Campbell University law students have brought home a national championship. For the first time in its history, Campbell's team has won the national title at the American Association of Justice Student Trial Advocacy Competition. Their performance was simply dominant, said Professor Dan Tilley, Campbell Law's Director of Advocacy. Campbell Law decisively won every contest, dropping only two judges' ballots of 18. Throughout the entirety of the tournament to remain the only unbeaten team in a highly competitive field. The victory is the school's third national title this year, following wins at the National ABA Client Counseling Championship in March and the Brown Mostyn International Client Consultation Competition in April. The streak arrives during Campbell Law's 10/40 celebration year, marking the 40th anniversary of the school's first graduation class and the 10th anniversary of its move to downtown Raleigh. And under the heading of Urban Artistry comes the article, Durham Ready to Unveil 95-Foot Mural at City Hall. A Durham mural that's expected to last 10 to 20 years is in its final stages of completion, a task being carried out by a Florence, Italy-trained artist born right here in the Old North State. The work, a 95-foot by 16-foot mural called Yesterday's Tomorrow, is being designed to speak for the employees of the Durham Planning Department. The piece is located at Durham City Hall. It features a synthesis of the North Carolina countryside and downtown Durham. Artist and Hillsborough resident Max Dowdle is using colors and symbolism derived from the Durham flag for the mural, which is expected to be complete April 23rd. Dowdle's work can also be found in such places as the Watergate Hotel, the Smithsonian Institution, and the U.S. Embassy in Brussels. And on the heading of real estate comes the article, Study, Raleigh Renters Getting Squeezed. Call it the price of growth. Renters in Raleigh, while still getting more space for the money, are getting squeezed more than their counterparts nationally in order to keep their monthly payment the same as it was 5 years ago, according to an analysis by HotPads, a unit of Zillow. The median U.S. rent is $1,530. The median size of a rental unit is 1,260 square feet. In 2014, that same $1,530 monthly rent payment would have given renters 225 more square feet of space. Meanwhile, in Raleigh, the median rent is slightly less at $1,485. The median size of a rental is much higher at 1,535 square feet, but in 2014, Raleigh renters would have gotten a place with 1,785 square feet, or 250 square feet more for that much money. The study looked at 50 metropolitan areas throughout the country. The disparity is even greater in Charlotte, as the median $1,400 today gets a 1,365 square foot place, whereas in 2014 it would have gotten the renter a 1,685 square foot place, a difference of 320 square feet. And under the heading of culinary expansion comes the article, Durham Tech Leases Space to Embark on Culinary Degree. If local educators' hopes come to fruition, the next greatest Triangle chefs will be trained in the heart of the American Tobacco Campus. Durham Technical Community College has leased a commercial kitchen in the heart of Durham's downtown to house its newest culinary arts degree program, which it hopes will turn out a new workforce of local chefs. The program is scheduled to begin in the fall of 2019. New talent is important for the growing industry, according to educators, who estimate there are more than 1,000 food and beverage operations in Durham and Orange counties alone. This is really an exciting time to be preparing people to work in the culinary and food service industries in this area, said Durham Tech President Bill Ingram. Not a week goes by where you don't find another extraordinary restaurant in the Triangle, and we're really excited at Durham Tech to start preparing people to work in this great industry. And under the heading of Big Blue Visits Red comes the article, As IBM Eyes Buying Red Hat, CEO Rometty Comes to NCSU. IBM CEO Jeannie Rometty is coming to Raleigh. Rometty has been tapped to deliver NC State University's commencement address May the 11th at PNC Arena. CEO of IBM since 2012, Rometty has an even bigger interest in the Triangle than Big Blue, which has a sprawling campus at nearby Research Triangle Park. Last year, IBM announced the mega buy of Red Hat for $34 billion, a move Rometty said will make IBM a global cloud leader. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading of Tourism, comes the article, Tiny House Hotel Ready to Greet Guests in Rocky Mount. And what's being referred to as a tiny house hotel, a Rocky Mount company behind the development is ready to book guests. But interested patrons will have to wait until June 1st to stay the night. A collection of luxury tiny homes and fully furnished guest houses at Rocky Mount Mills is ready to host guests. Called River and Twine, the hotel collection is made up of 20 guest houses and 3 one-bedroom guest suites built exclusively for the Rocky Mount Mills campus. A mixed-use community featuring office spaces, residences, restaurants, and a craft brewery incubator. River and Twine is housed in a renovated mill house dating back to the early 1900s. The last of the homes were completed last month, and the fleet, all built off-site, arrived in Rocky Mount on March the 10th. Bookings officially opened April 12th. Each unit accommodating 1 to 4 guests features the name of a different eastern North Carolina river and can be had for $129 a night. It's innovative, unique, and most importantly, creates the opportunity for an entirely new way to experience Rocky Mount Mills, said Evan Covington Chavez, real estate development manager at Rocky Mount Mills. We are so delighted to offer visitors attending any of the amazing events we have scheduled or just passing through our area the chance to make a night or weekend of it. Next, we turn to the technology and banking page in this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of HQ Move comes the article, Precision Hawk Moves HQ to Downtown Raleigh. Precision Hawk, currently operating from administrative offices on Six Forks Road in Raleigh, has tapped a space above Raleigh's Milk Bar for its new operation, confirms CEO Michael Chasen. At the new location, the company, which has hired 100 people in the first quarter alone, will grow its headcount to north of 350 by the end of the year. Taking advantage of the fast-moving drone industry, thanks to new FAA permissions. Right now, Precision Hawk's global population is about 250, and Chasen estimates Precision Hawk being at 300 in the next 2 months. Raleigh is where the bulk of its employees work, with representation from all the core groups, from sales to marketing and product development. Chasen says the headquarters search focused on downtown Raleigh from the beginning, though the team looked at multiple new buildings before settling on the Glenwood South area. I wanted to move the company to a spot that was even more central to the heart of the city, he says. Last year, the company inked $75 million in a single round from investors such as Third Point Ventures, Comcast Ventures, Senator Ventures Limited, Constellation Technology Ventures, and Syngenta Ventures. And under the heading of Legal Tussle comes the article, Cree Fights GE Lawsuit. Industrial giant General Electric, along with a former subsidiary, has lobbed a federal lawsuit against Durham semiconductor manufacturer Cree, accusing it of infringing on a group of patents. The lawsuit, filed by Current Lighting Solutions, GE, and Consumer Lighting LLC comes weeks after Cree's decision to sell its entire lighting division to Ideal Industries for up to $310 million, a deal the companies have said should close by the end of Cree's fourth fiscal quarter. Both Cree and Ideal declined to comment on the case. But could the lawsuit endanger the lighting deal? It could certainly complicate things, said Jim Verdonik, founder of Innovate Capital Law in Raleigh. The best time to sue a competitor is when they're trying to get a deal done, because you can screw up both Cree and the potential buyer by throwing a big ugly piece of mud in the middle of their beautiful deal, said Verdonik, who has no direct knowledge of the situation. Cree and the buyer have a much higher motivation to get this lawsuit settled than if a deal was not going on. In the 18-page suit, plaintiffs call the alleged infringement so obvious that it should have been known to defend it. And under the heading of gaming comes the article, Player Files Lawsuit Against Epic, Alleges Anguish. A new lawsuit calls out Carrie's Epic Games, accusing it of being responsible for a catastrophic cybersecurity vulnerability in its hit title, Fortnite, exposing its millions of players to possible identity theft in the process. Plaintiff Eric Krohm, individually and on behalf of similarly situated individuals, alleges in the suit that the resulting situation, which he claims allowed cyber criminals the ability to hijack Fortnite accounts and access players' credit card information, has caused him mental anguish. As a result of the vulnerability, he claims he has had to change account passwords and undergo credit monitoring. And he says Epic Games, who he alleges has been aware of the situation since November 2018, bears the blame and should pay up in the form of damages and attorney's fees. But Epic Games, which filed a motion to dismiss the case on April 15th for failure to state a claim, claims no such responsibility. Epic Games, through a spokeswoman, declined a request to comment for this story. But in a court memo, Epic Games, through attorney Jeffrey Jacobson of Kelly Dry and Warren LLP, claims Krohm bases his lawsuit on a purely theoretical data security vulnerability he saw reported in the media without alleging that his or anyone else's data was compromised. As Krohm suffered no injury and incurred no damages, the case should be dismissed, Epic Games argued. And also under the heading of banking comes the article, Why a Square One Exec Left for Signature Bank. When Ken Fugate co-founded entrepreneurially focused Square One Bank, it had just $100 million to leverage, which constrained us early on. This time, with a $47 billion asset bank behind us, we believe it will allow us to eliminate that constraint, he says. Fugate, along with about two dozen of his Square One cohorts, left the bank earlier this year. And as Triangle Business Journal first reported last month, they're embarking on a new challenge, creating the venture banking group for New York's Signature Bank. Fugate, based in Denver, will lead the operation. But with 10 of those Square One-turned-Signature bankers operating out of space in downtown Durham's WeWork, Durham will be a bit part of the venture banking group. And Fugate says the bank, just as Square One has always done, will continue to leverage the Triangle's startup ecosystem. Speaking for the first time on the record since joining Signature, he talks us through why the move is good for Durham and for the bank. Durham has always been a great hub of entrepreneurial activity and venture capital investment, he says. It will continue to be a major focus for us at Signature Bank. A lot of the senior talent we brought over with us was already based in Durham. Our track record there has been fantastic, so we are excited about continuing that. Fugate says Signature approached him about the opportunity. Signature Bank is excited about getting involved in the innovation economy, he explains. The bank had already built a fund banking group, working capital call lines, when they realized it would be good to start lending and banking the companies as well, he says. and they were attracted to our historical track record. Now we turn to the healthcare and education page of this week's TBJ, and under the heading of funding comes the article, Hatteras Group Banks $94 million for a new $200 million fund. A Triangle Venture Capital firm has brought in the first $94 million of its newest $200 million fund, spelling potential opportunities for early-stage companies in the area. Durham-based Hatteras Venture Partners announced the first closing of Hatteras Venture Partners 6, starting with $94 million, but expecting the full amount this year. Clay Thorpe, Hatteras co-founder and general partner, says, though the firm is still raising the rest of the capital, it has already closed on one investment and expects another in the coming weeks. Those investments were not disclosed. Thorpe says the focus of the fund will be largely similar to previous investment funds, with a stated focus on the entire healthcare industry. I would say we've honed it to really be investing across a continuum of healthcare innovation, from transformative therapy companies to breakthrough technology companies, he says. Though in recent years the company has taken a more national interest, Thorpe says he expects to lead a number of deals here, especially in the seed arena. He says he wouldn't be surprised if half the fund was invested in the southeastern U.S., largely in the Triangle. And under the heading of public offering comes the article, BDSI expects $50 million from Vital secondary offering. Following the announcement of the $30 million acquisition of U.S. commercialization rights to a Japanese drug, Raleigh's Bio Delivery Sciences International has priced its public offering, anticipating gross proceeds of $50 million. BDSI announced the acquisition of exclusive U.S. commercial rights for Shionogi's Symproic, a drug which treats opioid-induced constipation in adult patients with chronic non-cancer pain. The rights will cost the company $20 million up front and another $10 million 6 months down the road, as well as tiered royalty payments. BDSI, whose CEO is Herm Kukier, has just $43.8 million in cash and cash equivalents as of December 31st. The company wants to use the secondary offering to pay for the acquisition. Wall Street offered a muted reaction. The 12 million share offering has been priced at $5 per share. In addition, underwriters have a 30-day option to purchase up to an additional 1.8 million shares from a selling stockholder. The offering was scheduled to close April 15th. And under the heading of strategy comes the article, after $235 million bet, AskBio embarks on a journey. AskBio has been quietly operating in Research Triangle Park since 2001, but the company is making a big bet with a $235 million investment, moving from a revenue-positive company to burning capital to bring a multitude of therapeutics onto the market. As it was known before, Asklepios Pharmaceuticals is a developer and manufacturer of adeno-associated virus, sometimes called AAV, gene therapy therapeutics for the treatment of rare and usually untreatable genetic disorders. A UNC Chapel Hill spinout, it's been operating since 2001 off just $5 million in seed money, reporting positive revenue every single year of its operations, according to its CEO, Sheila McHale, except in 2018. That change came from the company significantly ramping up research and development, McHale says, which began pulling from the company's reserves. Those reserves were accumulated through revenue streams, such as the licensing of its products, the sale of two spinouts, Bamboo Therapeutics and Chatham Therapeutics, as well as excess capacity at a Spain manufacturing facility. Like typical R&D, we're running pretty significant cash outflows now, and that's why we decided to go for this Series A, she says. We just couldn't self-finance anymore or sort of bootstrap because pushing that many therapeutics, we needed a significant cash infusion. The company readily found that infusion. To TPG Capital and Vida Ventures, based in Boston and Fort Worth, Texas, respectively, have invested $225 alongside $10 million from the company's board for a minority stake in the company, which McHale says will be used for an aggressive expansion strategy. That strategy has a company shopping for an RTP-based manufacturing site that it hopes to fill with more than 100 new employees. McHale says the company is also planning to expand its R&D and administrative staff, more than doubling its headcount from 47 to 100 in the next 18 months. The remaining capital will go to funding its therapeutic pipeline, which McHale says enables a strategy of introducing 2 to 3 more candidates into trials per year. We've been working on so many programs because we measure our success largely, in part, by how many lives we can impact, she says. So this additional capital will be able to treat a lot more diseases, many of which have no treatment. The bet the company is making is that some or many of those therapeutics will come onto the market and begin generating revenue, which McHale says could happen within 5 years. The risk is the amount of money involved with pushing multiple drugs through clinical trials at the same time, hoping they are approved. We're making big investments in our therapeutic pipeline, and as a consequence, that's going to burn cash, she says. But we're expecting to be able to launch those products. And under the heading of new policy comes the article, Duke's Academic Council Chair Wary of Stipend Increase Impact. Duke University's decision to commit to providing all PhD students 12-month stipends may benefit its graduate students for decades to come. But one Duke professor says implementing the policy will invoke tough choices as the university shifts toward the more expensive model. Duke has committed to funding 12-month stipends for all its PhD students beginning in fall 2022. Currently, there are about 2,400 PhD students enrolled who are provided either 9 or 12-month stipends. The stipend for the full academic year is $31,160. At current enrollment, the stipends will cost the university more than $74 million. Implementing the stipend policy across the 54 graduate programs may require cutting, downsizing, or amending many of those programs, according to one Duke professor. Don Taylor, a professor of public policy and chair of the academic council at Duke, says by making the sweeping commitment, the university has locked itself into a policy, and it ultimately does not have the extra funding. Everybody thinks that Duke has bags of millions of dollars lying around. We have more money than all but 8 or 10 universities in the world, but we spend like those 8 or 10, he says. The place where the hardest decisions come, because it's where most students are with 9-month stipends, is in arts and sciences. And finally, from the healthcare and education page under the heading of New Building, comes the article, Align Technology Buys Marshall Headquarters Building for $58 million. A California company that has been steadily growing in the Triangle has upped their investment in the region, spending $58.1 million to purchase its building with intent to continue expanding. Align Technology, which is headquartered in San Jose, California, but calls the Triangle home to its Americas region headquarters, purchased the office building off Slater Road. The building is part of the 4540 Office Park, a joint venture effort by Federal Capital Partners and of Chevy Chase, Maryland, and Strategic Capital Partners of Indianapolis. Align first opened a Triangle office in July 2015 with just 14 employees. It now has more than 400 employees in the region. Since taking its place as a tenant of the 4540 building, the company has been steadily expanding its lease to accommodate for more expansion. The Marshall facility is one of only 2 locations in the U.S. for Align. Next, we turn to the real estate page in this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of School Business comes the article, Wake School Board Buys Raleigh Properties for $1.5 million. The Wake County Board of Education purchased 2 properties in Raleigh last month for more than $1.5 million. One will be used by a nearby elementary school, while the other completes ownership of a 7-condominium building next to a middle school. Gerald W. Mann, successor trustee of the Inez Haley Mann Trust, sold 4.6 acres on 5701 Tryon Road to the Wake County Board for $1.11 million. The property, which had been in the Mann family since 1958, is located adjacent to Swift Creek Elementary School. The land gives the school system some flexibility as it plans an upcoming major renovation of the school. Shepherd, Inc., whose president is Jose I. Isazi of Winston-Salem, sold 4600 New Bern Avenue, number 101, to the board for $427,000. The school system now owns the entire nearly 12,000-square-foot Headingham Oaks II condominium building, as unit number 101 was the last of the 7 condos in the building to be purchased. In 2004, the Wake County Board of Education purchased the 2.13 acres next door at 4700 New Bern Avenue for $3.2 million and put River Oaks Middle School there. The River Oaks campus currently houses Transportation Administration and Routing, the SCORE Alternative Learning Program, Career and Technical Education Testing Administration and Materials, and the Office of Early Learning Development Screening. A decision on how to use the new space has not yet been made. The space needs analysis and prioritization process was developed to identify, consider, and meet space needs that are outside typical parameters for standard school site development, said Lisa Luton, Communications Director of the Wake County Public School Systems, adding that the space needs analysis and prioritization process had already identified the need for more space in the central Raleigh area. And under the heading of sold comes the article, New York Investors Buy Raleigh Building for $28.5 million. A 50-year-old West Raleigh building was sold to a pair of New York investors. A 5-story office building on 2610 Wycliffe Road was sold by a Boston concern to investors from New York City for $28.5 million. That's a $5.5 million increase from the price paid by the sellers just 4 years ago. Alvarez and Marcel Property Investments, with founding directors Tony Alvarez II and Brian Marcel, bought the 174,000-square-foot building that sits on nearly 10 acres. The sale price equates to about $164 per square foot. Albany Road Real Estate Partners of Boston bought the property in 2015 for $28 million, after the previous owner, Garrison Investments of New York City, had spent $3.2 million on renovating the facility, which was built in 1970. Garrison's renovations included complete restroom renovation, elevator modernization, an upgrade to the energy management system, parking lot expansion and resurfacing, fitness center renovation, and a conference room upgrade. In 2012, Garrison bought the property for $8 million. So in 7 years, the selling price has more than tripled. Located adjacent to the Lake Boone Trail and I-440 intersection and next to Martin Marietta, the building is 92.5% occupied, with the major tenants being engineering firm Dewberry, General Dynamics, and Hewlett-Packard Enterprises. The building's new owner, Alvarez & Marsal, which engages in various enterprises, including financial consulting, has grown from 3 employees in 1983 to more than 3,000 in 55 offices across 24 countries. And under the heading of Wolfpack Digs comes the article, More Student Housing Planned for Hillsborough Street Near NCSU. A major Chicago investment firm is planning to build more housing focused on students at NC State University near the burgeoning Hillsborough Street corridor. Construction on a large townhome community called Latitude on Hillsborough begins later this month near the intersection of Hillsborough Street and Western Boulevard in Raleigh. Teddy Hobbs, vice president of Phoenix Commercial Properties, assembled the project's 17 parcels of land from 11 different homeowners and commercial property owners on behalf of CA Ventures, which purchased the properties for a total of more than $5.6 million. The combined assessed value of the property is about $3 million. The parcels in the Oakdale neighborhood, which dates back to 1923, run along Burton Avenue, Hillsborough Street, Oakdale Street, Waycross Street, and Western Boulevard on nearly 10 acres. The move continues the heavy investment in properties focused on students at NC State and other universities. In February, CA Ventures spent $12.2 million for 2.5 acres along Hillsborough Street near Dixie Trail. The company plans to build a 243,000-square-foot apartment building. Next, we turn to the news page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and on that we find, under the heading of Education, the article Emails Detail Former UNC Chancellor's Deep Frustrations. Recently released emails from UNC Chapel Hill suggest deep frustration from former Chancellor Carol Folt to the University of North Carolina system leaders, and that she decided to blindside the Board of Governors with her announcement. On January 14th, the university announced a sudden and unexpected resignation of Folt. The public statement regarding her resignation and her decision to remove the remnants of the controversial Silent Sam Confederate Memorial went out at 5 p.m., the same time the Board of Governors was in an emergency closed-door meeting. At 7:20 p.m. that day, Board Chairman Harry Smith said he was unaware of Folt's intentions until the public statement, and he blasted her actions by saying, "We're incredibly disappointed at this intentional action. It lacks transparency, and it undermines and insults the board's goal to operate with class and dignity." But emails obtained by a Triangle Business Journal from the day of Folt's resignation depict a slow, methodical process of Folt and her advisors drafting her public resignation, as well as drafting a letter meant to inform the board of her intentions that was delayed until after her public statement. In those letters, Folt takes a decidedly stronger stance than what ended up in her public announcement, citing her growing agitation with the statue and controversy dating back to the riots in Charlottesville, Virginia, and her worry about the liability of the university and herself should matters continue escalating. The final, expanded version, apparently meant for the Board of Governors, was sent from Folt to Locklear at 4:32 p.m., nearly a half hour before her announcement went public. Notably, this version, unlike previous versions to UNC leaders, begins by referring to her yet-to-be-released public statement, suggesting Folt purposefully did not inform the board of her announcements until after they were made public. There is also a stark difference in the severity of her public statements and her final letter to the board. Folt's public announcement begins with her resignation and hopeful statements about the university's future. In addressing the removal of the statue, Folt uses general language about the statue posing a continuing threat both to the personal safety and well-being of our community, as well as at threats that continue to grow and place our community at serious risk. But in her letter to the UNC system leaders, Folt leads with an exhaustive explanation of her concerns about the statue, her frustration with the process, and her legal right to remove the statue. "Ever since Charlottesville, I've been telling and writing you with my serious concerns regarding public safety risk to campus associated with the presence of Silent Sam," she said in the first lines of the letter. "Just this week, our police told me again that the risk of physical violence and personal injury, civil disorder, and property damage are high in the vicinity of the monument's base." Folt continues to point out that her preference, as well as the UNC Board of Trustees' preference, has been to prevent the return of the statue to campus, citing that it could not even place herself in liability, that it could even place herself in liability for not taking action. "Indeed, it's my opinion that anything other than removing the base and tablets for now would be irresponsible, place the community at continued and growing risk," she says, "and place me as chancellor, the university, and the system at a risk of greater liability for not taking their responsibility for public safety seriously enough." Folt also invokes her conversation with UNC's general counsel, Mark Merritt, and North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein regarding her legal authority to remove the statue, even including a note to add a supporting letter from Merritt. They agree that the law does not contemplate the situation we now find ourselves in, she said. It does not apply to damaged objects of remembrance, nor does it say anything about ensuring a damaged and disassembled monument must be repaired or replaced, she said. In her last lines to the board, Folt addresses her commitment to serving out the remainder of the semester and forwarding the university's ongoing capital campaign. I'm excited about what I can accomplish in my remaining time as chancellor by focusing my full attention on the core mission of the university, doing all I can to be sure everyone on our campus can thrive and feel welcome, and pushing forward with the capital campaign and the work of the History Task Force, she said. I also look forward to making this a great term for my sixth class of graduates, she said at the time. But that day never came, as the UNC board moved up Folt's departure timeline. Next, we turn to this week's cover story, and it's entitled Roe's Journey to Forward a Family's Legacy. Five stories of glass stretch into the sky out of a dirt patch as the new building in Durham seems to reflect more light than it manages to bask in. The glittering panels almost seem to hold the building aloft as they crescendo toward three green letters at its peak, R-H-O. Soon, grass will overtake the freshly overturned soil, and the stretches of asphalt will be populated with cars as a company unifies its employees in one place. But the tower also marks another momentous bet, that one of the Triangle's most prominent contract research organizations, known as CROs, Roe, can thrive despite massive challenges facing its industry, including growing prices and workplace trends that have employees opting for remote work instead of finely crafted structures. At the helm sits a 49-year-old woman, Laura Helms-Reese, who, along with her brother Ross Helms, have steered this journey in the past 7 years after taking over the business from their parents, who started Roe in 1984. Our real strength is our people, says Russ, who shares the title of the CEO with his sister. We are a professional services firm. What we offer is our people. Roe's rise has mirrored the remarkable emergence of CROs in the Triangle. Reese, one of the rare female CEOs in the Triangle running a science-based entity, says she joined the company because there were no other jobs for PhD-level biostatisticians in the Triangle. Those days are long gone. The Triangle is home to more than 125 CROs, employing more than 16,700 employees, according to the most recent NC Biotechnology Center data. Massive CROs, such as ICVIA, known as Quintiles formerly, RTI International, PPD, PRA Health Sciences, and Senios Health maintain thousands of employees each in sprawling campuses throughout the region, with many of those working, earning well north of $100,000 every year. And yet the industry is facing a cloud of challenges that has resulted in consolidation, layoffs, order cancellations, and perhaps most concerning, severe price and margin pressure. In 2016, Quintiles was acquired by Connecticut-based IMS Health before becoming ICVIA. And just this year, Duke Clinical Research Institute, a 1,300-employee operation, announced layoffs are coming. Even mid-size Roe, with about $85 million in revenue, saw slumping top-line revenue in 2018, a surprising turn for a company which, until the year before, was growing at a double-digit clip. But the brother and sister pair believe 2018 was an aberration, adding things can only turn around in 2019 and beyond on the backs of their most prized assets, its employees. This building is in some aspects an investment more than a statement. We're investing in a place where we think we can attract and retain great people, Helms said. Roe scientists take a company's drug through the pipeline from inception to commercialization, acting as consultants, crafting clinical trials, providing regulatory and statistical support, and guiding a company's drug through the U.S. Food and Drug Administration process. With the complexity of modern drugs, CROs rely heavily on the expertise of its employees, often tailoring and marketing its services toward the therapeutic areas where its employees have deep experience. Finding these great people, however, is becoming more difficult. Laura Rowley, Director of Life Science Economic Development at NC Biotech, says CROs are increasingly facing a tightening job market. Getting qualified workforce is something on everyone's mind, she says. That, I would say, is probably one of the greatest challenges, just because everyone wants the best of the best, because that's what allows them to compete whenever they are being considered. With a single-digit employee turnover rate, Reese says even a moderately sized company such as Roe, which currently has about 20 unfilled positions, is seeing a workforce increasingly unequipped to meet market demand. In fact, she says the company has turned to using more contractors than they prefer. Heaven knows the incredibly tight labor market is hurting us all, she says. You can't stretch the number of CRAs, that's clinical research associates, that exist in the industry right now to the number of open positions. We can't do all the work that exists out there right now. Rowley says the major obstacle for CROs is that few come out of the educational pipeline eyeing the industry, instead finding their ways to companies such as Roe through gateway industries in life sciences and analytics. Solving that issue takes creative issue solutions, such as internships and training programs, but mostly boils down to cutthroat competition between companies over their employees. It's figuring out how to get around a bottleneck that's a tough bottleneck to get around, she says, because experience, really, you can only get through experience. Reese and Helms say Roe's strategy centers around recruitment and retainment, and the new building makes a major leap for a company that's been careful about when to scale up. In its 34 years, it's hardly ever met aggressive growth standards. In fact, industry experts and Roe's leadership agree that the company understanding its place as a mid-sized CRO has paved the way for its stability. Culturally, our industry is one that hires up fast and expensive when they need something and they lay off. It's very much a peak and valley industry. And that's not us, Reese says. People don't come and spend a career someplace where they're just waiting for the next layoff. Our strategy has been to hang on to people, to hire really great people, and to hang on to them. Reese and Helms pride themselves on the fact that Roe has never had layoffs. Rowley says that looking over the Triangle CRO industry, Roe does stand out for its employee loyalty and retention. She says much of that has to do with the company being open about what kind of work it does and the aspirations it has. There are large groups that kind of can do anything, but I think that where you see some success is whenever a CRO looks and finds its niche, she says. They're not necessarily going head-to-head with a PPD, IGVIA, or a Syneos on every project, but they're understanding niches and therapeutic targets on respiratory diseases, and we do really well when it's preclinical phase two. Specifically, Roe specializes on pain management, respiratory, psychiatric disorders, and pediatrics, as well as hematology, ophthalmology, dental, and the central nervous system. To date, the company has conducted more than 90 respiratory studies at 800 sites involving nearly 20,000 patients. The company also focuses its commercial interest on early stage and startup companies that require more consulting than major drug companies. Greg Blake, a managing partner at BroCare Partners, a healthcare-focused corporate finance advisor, says that's an important strategy as major drug companies increasingly become less interested in early stage drugs and more focused on acquiring late stage candidates and marketing them. Pharmaceutical companies used to develop drugs, he says, and this is somewhat simplistic to say, but more and more they're marketing engines. They tend to acquire and license products when they're late in development. That strategy is leaving the impetus of drug creation and the available contracts for early stage drugs in the hands of smaller companies and startups that need far more advice and consolation as they head into clinical trials. Clay Thorpe, co-founder and clinical partner of Hatteras Venture Partners, a Durham venture capital firm that invests in life sciences, says he agrees that smaller to mid-sized CROs are increasingly called to rely on the expertise of their staff and target specialties, because as consolidation continues to create more powerful mega CROs, the prospect of generally competing is impossible. The company needs to have super specialized expertise where it's undeniable you should hire it, he says. Because to try to compete on a generalized basis with the big firms is pretty tough. The second part behind Roe's retention strategy is to give the employees the most benefits the company can afford to give and hope those benefits translate to increased productivity and loyalty. That strategy has most recently manifested itself in their new headquarters, a proverbial monument to a company closely guarded by the brother and sister CEOs. It's very hard to get in here, Helms says. We make it very difficult to get in, and we screen people very heavily to make sure they're going to fit in and that they're going to be team players. Once through the doors, though, the company wants to keep them. The headquarters is laid out in a purposefully egalitarian fashion, with no corner offices or specially tailored C-suite. Executives are interspaced throughout the building in clusters most closely associated with their line of work. Workspaces are outfitted in all the trappings of modern office convenience: open spaces, adjustable desk, cafes, free coffee, and abundant windows. The company even offers an in-house concierge service to all their employees, who can call upon the service to run errands, collect groceries, and even wrap Christmas presents. Also available is space for employees' children to play video games. Those benefits, coupled with a flexible environment regarding out-of-work responsibilities, have had one noticeable effect. And a workforce that industry experts say is split about evenly between male and female workers, Roe reports nearly 70% of their employees as female, many in their 30s with young children. We've had employee health care since the time we had 5 employees, because that was a minimum you could buy a package for, Reese says. As a result, I think we've always been working parent-friendly, and that tends to attract more women. That employee retention begets more contacts, which in turn has kept Roe steadily growing as customers return and see familiar faces. The word of mouth that we have here is really effective, Helms says. Still, CROs face rising difficulties as the nature and cost of their industry evolves. Reese says she worries about the increasing cost of research and developing and of drugs in general. That's particularly worrisome for a company such as Roe, which has placed its emphasis on smaller companies with smaller R&D budgets and stomachs for risky drug ventures. The increasing costs of developing drugs, while in the short run that makes our business better, in the long run, I think scares some people away from doing some of the development that needs to be done, she says. According to Grandview Research, an investment advisory company, the global CRO market is expected to reach $54.7 billion by 2025, expanding at a rate of about 6.6% year to year. That growth, the report states, is driven primarily by the increasing cost of drug development. Drug maker and sponsor companies are under pressure to replace the revenue loss caused by generics, increasing patent expirations, number of partnerships to identify biologics, and growing R&D costs, which has made drug development more expensive and complex, the report states. An analysis by Brocare notes that the growth is also pushed by the pharmaceutical companies looking to CROs as a means to reduce clinical trial costs, resulting in the CRO market growing faster than R&D spending. In 2016, the report states 41% of clinical trials were outsourced to CROs, and it is estimated to increase to 50% by the end of this year. Blake says at Brocare, they have noted that while Big Pharma is turning to CRAs to reduce their R&D costs, they're still penny-pinching with their budgets. That trend is moving the large contacts further away from mid-sized CROs like Roe and into the hands of the giant companies that offer end-to-end services in more areas. They're often looking for ways to make that process less expensive. One of the main ways they've been doing that is buying from fewer vendors, he says, which is part of the thing driving consolidation in the market. And while increasing drug development costs and more business going to CROs due to slowing R&D budgets is a good sign in the near term, the pair combines for a troubling possibility down the road. Those worries are not restricted to just the commercial side. According to Helms and Reese, Roe currently operates about evenly between federal and commercial contracts, but has been leaning toward more federal research dollars in recent years. For us, on the federal side of the business, for a long time in our lifetime, there was a lot of agreement. no matter political affiliation, on the value that NIH and EPA-sponsored research brought to society, Rees says. So even in times of great political fighting, the NIH and other scientific agencies tended to do really well. That appears to have gone, or be changing. As a result of that, having a toehold in different parts of the government that ebbs and flows with different political situations seemed like a really good idea. For instance, the White House's proposed budget for fiscal year 2020 would cut NIH funding by 12%, or $4.7 billion. If approved, the agency estimates funding for research grants would decline 15%, and the total number of awarded grants would drop from over 41,000 this year to less than 39,000. However, Congress has rejected the administration's proposal to cut NIH funding over the past 3 years, instead providing multi-billion-dollar increases. Helms says Roe anticipated many of those changing sentiments years ago and began pursuing Department of Defense contracts that have proven to be a secure and stable source of work. Rees is quick to note the company is still primarily interested in research in the psychiatric and pain management side of DOD contracts, that Roe is not transitioning to building weapons. At Hatteras, Thorpe said finding sources of stability is essential to competing in the CRO market. The challenge with CROs is you build the level of bookings, he says. You have to worry about project cancellations for a variety of reasons, and that can be lumpy. The companies that figure out how to smooth out those lumps have a pretty good chance of success. In fact, Helms says Roe's dip in 2018 was due to a contract not starting when it was supposed to, affecting the company's top-line forecast, something that the company hopes more stable, long-term government contracts will insulate it from. It was in large part some timing, she says. We sold a lot of work that just didn't start when it was supposed to, so we had to work tail off and had some stuff not stirred up. Helms said CROs are also increasingly competing for patients at investigative sites throughout the world, especially in the U.S. There's a limited patient population in the United States, so more of the trials are global, and we're very focused on domestic, he says. But we think the domestic market is big enough for us. Regardless of new and complicated challenges, Rees and Helms say they plan to continue focusing on having a strong corporate culture and recruiting the right people, as well as fostering loyalty in their clients. Their new headquarters is also a sign the company believes in the value of the old way of doing things. Whereas industry experts say one of the opportunities coming to CROs in the future is a lack of necessity for employees to be clustered in the same space or even cities, Roe is proudly boasting a headquarters with everyone in the same space. It's not so much a sign of affluence, Rees says, but it's a stake in the ground that we work together best face to face. This week's guest editorial on the Viewpoint page is entitled Solving North Carolina's Insurance Coverage Gap Issues and is written by Alexander Sirota. Sirota is the director of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. North Carolina's dubious ranking of having the 10th highest rate of uninsured people in the nation continues to play out across the state in ways that challenge our collective well-being and community stability. Even as it leads to worse health outcomes and diminished livelihoods for hundreds of thousands of our neighbors, it's thus a welcome relief that there's momentum growing in state law and policymaking circles to close the coverage gap. The reality is that the coverage gap affects us all. When large segments of the population are unable to get the care they need, and institutions are left without a sound financing model for delivering health care, we are all worse off. But just as we need to be clear about the problem and its extent, we should also be clear that not all solutions to the problem are equal. Just last week, Republican leaders introduced their approach to closing the coverage gap, calling it a uniquely North Carolina approach. Unfortunately, whatever the motivations of its proponents, the substance of the proposal flies in the face of what North Carolinians support and need. It does not recognize our shared fate, nor does it commit to strengthening the connections to opportunity provided through affordable, quality health care. Instead, it proposes to block access for many and fails to recognize the fundamental and systemic changes facing those without health insurance in 21st century North Carolina. Research both nationally and from my colleagues at the North Carolina Justice Center highlights some serious problems with this proposal, problems that will cause it to fall short of closing the coverage gap, and worse, likely to lead to even more harmful conditions for North Carolinians. Any proposal that our state legislators consider to support the health and well-being of our North Carolinians should follow the evidence as to what really works. Now, there are three main goals listed, and in the interest of time, I'm going to simply provide the synopsis of those three goals. One, maximize the number of people in North Carolina with health insurance coverage. Two, finance health care coverage in a fiscally responsible way. North Carolina has missed out on federal dollars since 2013, but the state can still draw down federal funding to cover 90% of the cost of providing health care service to those and the coverage gap. And three, don't erect costly barriers like work and premium requirements that result in coverage losses and greater hardship. The bottom line, the current proposal on the table from House lawmakers, while welcome in its recognition of the need to make health insurance coverage available to more North Carolinians, falls short of being the kind of approach that North Carolinians should support or be proud of. And as we close out this week's program, I would like to read to you the results of the ACBJ Business Survey Pulse. And the question before the Pulse was, which of the following would you most like to experience on your next business trip? Now, there were 2,156 responders, and the breakdown is as follows. 46% would like a free upgrade. 35% would like an open seat next to them. 10% would like a prospective client seated next to them. 6% the first to deplane. And 3% the first to board. So, there you have it from the 2,156 responders to the question, which of the following would you most likely to experience on your next business trip? Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.